You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is the last lecture, Lecture 16, given in Dornach on the 7th of January, 1922. And there's what follows this after this one's over will be a question and answer. I'm calling it a Lecture 17, which is in this final lecture of our conference about an education based on anthroposophy, based upon anthroposophical insight into the human being, I should like to speak about the moral and religious aspect in teaching, two kindred subjects which naturally belong together. Once again, there is only time for a few characteristic observations. There's hardly any other subject where one feels equally strongly how important it is that an all-embracing and unifying spirit, born out of a real knowledge of man, should pervade all aspects and all branches of education. Yesterday I spoke to you about physical education. Today's theme can only be considered to be a truly spiritual one, and this very much so when we look at it from the spirit of our time. Right from the beginning I wish to emphasize that these two subjects, physical and spiritual in nature, will have to flow together to form a unity in the kind of education we are considering here, although they tend to be treated as two rather separate branches in traditional education. For this to happen in general may well take its time, but in our Waldorf school we have tried to make a small beginning of this initiative, intimate flowing together of spiritual and physical activities, by introducing eurythmy, which is an obligatory subject in all its classes and which could be looked upon as a kind of soul and spiritual form of gymnastics. This eurythmy uses the human physical body as a medium in order to express everything it has to bring. Yet, at the same time, right down to the smallest detail, every movement is meaningfully permeated by what is of a soul and spiritual nature. Eurythmy depends on the physical organs in a similar way, in which speech depends on the human speech organs, without which there could be no oral communications. These physical speech organs are the carriers of soul and spiritual content. Just as the spiritual element in language can lead one directly into the moral and even religious sphere, if one is only perceptive enough, for it is not without reason that the Gospel of St. John begins with, quote, "In the beginning was the Word," close quote, so one can say, this flowing together of body, soul, and spirit, though in a lesser-known subject and in an as yet more instinctive way, is being cultivated by the teaching of eurythmy in every class of the Waldorf School. Although directly linked to physical movements, eurythmy is one of the subjects which can show perhaps more clearly than any other how this unification of body, soul, and spirit can be methodically practiced in actual class lessons. In future times, many other activities will have to stand side by side with eurythmy, offering possibilities as yet undreamt of by present-day mankind, and working even more directly into the soul and spiritual realm. Such possibilities are inherent in what has already been given, waiting to be realized. The way is there. Even if our first efforts in eurythmy are far from perfect and limited in scope, all one-sidedness in gymnastics, resulting from the materialistic influences of our times, will eventually be overcome through the principles of eurythmy. One really feels an inner urge to speak about the ethical and religious aspects of education, even if this can be done only aphoristically. On the one hand, one wishes to appeal most strongly to what all human beings share as a common bond beyond the confines of race and nationality. On the other, one cannot help realizing that it is almost impossible to speak about matters so intimately connected with people's inner lives in a way which will be both understood and accepted by members of all nations. One example may suffice to show how very different people's moral and religious attitudes are in different regions of the earth, and how one therefore feels inhibited when trying to reach them on this particular level. In reality, such intimate questions of morality and religion can be approached only through the national and religious background of the people concerned. In all previous considerations of our conference theme, I could speak in far more general terms about human affairs than is possible for me today. But the anthroposophical way of looking at the world engenders a strong desire to build bridges across all divisions into nationalities, races, and so on. In its inmost being, anthroposophy feels impelled to speak with a supranational, with an international voice. Nevertheless, one is acutely aware of the difficulties involved when speaking with the voice of universal humanity about such intimate matters of human life, especially in the contemporary scene, which, after all, is the reality confronting us. Therefore, I must beg you to take what I am going to say with the attitude mentioned just now. It is given as an example to illustrate the deep gulfs dividing mankind. During the course of these lectures, I have often referred to Herbert Spencer, who, whatever one's personal opinion of his philosophy may be, nevertheless has to be regarded as an exponent of Western civilization. I have also indicated that this Herbert Spencer has put into the world definite educational principles, one of which could be summarized in the following way. It is man's aim on earth to reproduce his kind, and consequently it is in his moral interests to bring up and to educate his offspring accordingly. He must therefore endeavor to provide suitable parents and educators. Such, approximately, are Herbert Spencer's views, which begin with and aim at a physical picture of man. He follows the development of the human race with an eye on its reproduction, and adapts his educational aims accordingly. Now let us look at another personality, who, through living a little later, nevertheless can be regarded as a representative of the Eastern world outlook. Let us consider the philosophy of Vladimir Soloviev. Footnote: Vladimir Soloviev, 1853 to 1900. End footnote. Though expressing himself in Western terminology, a truly Russian folk soul speaks through his works. And so we find that the ethical and religious aims of Vladimir Soloviev have a very different message for mankind, one which is permeated by the spirit of the East. He says, on the one hand, man must strive for perfection with regard to truth, and on the other, he must partake of immortality. Here, Soloviev does not imply the earthly kind of immortality resulting from fame or glory, but he speaks of the real immortality of the soul, which rightly belongs to every human soul. He goes on to say, without this striving toward perfection and truth, in other words, without the attainment of real knowledge, human existence would be worthless. Only if one is able to perfect oneself more and more will human life gain in value. However, if the human soul were denied immortality, then all perfection, all ability to strive toward perfection, would be nothing but a monstrous cosmic deception, for then all human achievements in the search for truth would sink under, and humankind would be cheated of its most precious aspirations by the very cosmic foundations themselves. However, so claims Soloviev, this would be the case if, in its earthly development, mankind were to look upon the reproduction of the human species as the final and most important aim. For then mankind's special task in the world would be shunted from one generation to the next, and man's course would be like the rolling of an unchanging wheel, at least with regard to his moral values of existence. In short, out of the Eastern spirit, Soloviev rejects, in the clearest and strongest terms, the Western ideals of Herbert Spencer. This twofold way of experiencing and judging mankind's task on earth colors all the many divisions with regard to moral and religious issues. If one wishes to gain an understanding of mankind's ethical and moral aims, one must first of all free oneself from any prejudice, and then one needs to make an honest effort to comprehend the various diverging philosophies of life. The opposite views of the two representative thinkers, quoted above, can serve as an indication of how differently mankind is constituted with regard to the intimate subject under discussion today. It is the very aim of the anthroposophical world outlook to help people, wherever they may live on earth, toward an understanding beyond the barriers of race or national language. Consequently, anthroposophy endeavors to speak in a supranational language. This, of course, not in any physical sense, but in a language which can be understood throughout our present civilization. Today, these aims can be realized only to a limited extent, but even the first steps will enable us to appreciate also wider issues. For, as soon as we become clearer about what has just been said, we will realize how little we can achieve in the moral and religious field of education if we introduce religious dogmas or fixed moral concepts to children. At best, we could teach them to become Christians, Jews, Roman Catholics, or Protestants, according to our own religious beliefs. However, any attempt to indoctrinate the young in our own particular ideology must be eradicated from the true art of education. One specific problem in education may help to clarify and illustrate this point. It is something which will make us pay due respect to matters pertaining to human freedom, also in the case of a child, and that we must have respect for the inherent freedom of the child, we shall soon realize if we say to ourselves, a feeble-minded pupil ought to be treated with the same care as a bright one, or even as a budding genius. What would happen if teachers adopted the principle that pupils ought to absorb only what was near to their own souls? Through his corporeality, a person of subnormal intelligence is born with a heavy burden. A genius is born with wings to his soul. We must confess to ourselves that we are called upon to carry our share of the burden of the imbecile. But we must also admit that as teachers we may not be able to follow the flight of a young genius. Otherwise every school would have to be staffed with geniuses of the highest order, and this is hardly possible. Nevertheless, our ways of teaching must ensure that we do not impede the progress of an inherent genius. Never must we clip the wings of a genius's spirit. This we can achieve only by developing an art of education which does not interfere with the spiritual forces that must be allowed to work freely in the growing human being. Toward this end, all previous considerations of this conference have been directed, and if you examine them at greater depth, you will find it so. You will also find that the principles of Waldorf education can be implemented in practical life in such a way that the teacher needs to deal only with what can be developed in the child by him, even if the pupil will eventually grow into a genius. Just as a dwarfed teacher cannot prevent his pupil from growing into a physical giant, just as he cannot intervene in the free unfolding of the pupil's physical growth, so his own spiritual limitations need not hamper his pupil's innate possibilities of spiritual growth. Their later lives will remain unimpeded by a teacher's inevitable shortcomings if he takes his stand on a knowledge of man which emanates from the complete human being, in the same way in which the powers of physical growth do. I therefore welcome the fact that something has emerged in the Waldorf School at Stuttgart which may easily escape the notice of a passing visitor, but which, nevertheless, is a concrete reality. It is the spirit of the Waldorf School which has its own independent existence irrespective of the personal situation of the individual staff members, whose soul and spiritual lives thrive on the communal efforts to cultivate it. It is this spirit which will encourage the teachers, more and more, to educate children, even if it means having to bear their heavy yoke of subnormality. The teacher's joint study of the human being will help them to carry this burden, but at the same time, they will also make every effort to avoid the educational sin of hampering the free unfolding of a highly gifted pupil. This is our ideal. It is an ideal of which it need not be said that it exists only in cloud cuckoo land, for every day concerted efforts are being made to bring it down into daily life at the Waldorf School. When dealing with moral and religious aspects of education, we cannot draw our content from existing ideologies, confessional religions, or established ethical impulses. Our task will be so to reach the pupil's inner being that, in accordance with their destinies, they will be able to find their way in freedom toward working together with their fellow men in the social sphere. Consequently, in our teaching, we do not begin by appealing to their conceptual faculties, for knowledge, though providing content, does not offer the possibility to live oneself into the intimate regions of the soul. When imparting knowledge, and this we are bound to do in our school, when addressing ourselves to the faculty of thinking as one of the three soul faculties, we must realize that this thinking, too, will have to be channeled toward ethical aims. However, when we are dealing with the moral and religious aspects of education, we must appeal first and foremost to the pupil's life of feeling. Neither can we address ourselves directly to the will sphere, because a person's activities immediately link him or her to the social scene, and what has to be performed there is largely determined by the prevailing conditions and contemporary demands within the social sphere. And so, we cannot turn directly to thinking, which always wants to go in a certain direction, nor to willing, which is bound to take its impulses from prevailing social conditions. But we can always appeal to feeling, which to a certain extent is the private domain of each individual. And if we appeal to this element in our teaching, we shall meet with those forces in the human soul which are of a moral and religious order. Yet we must go further than cultivating the pupil's thinking, feeling, and willing, as if each faculty were a separate entity. We must endeavor to train all soul forces simultaneously. Obviously, it would be wrong to concentrate on the training of thinking in a one-sided way, nor would it be right to concentrate on the will alone. What we have to do is to let the element of feeling flow into both the sphere of thinking and of willing. With regard to thinking, only knowledge of the world and of man, which rests on an anthroposophical foundation, can be of real help to us, for it allows us to build upon a physical and material basis. With this kind of knowledge, we can safely turn to subjects such as physics and chemistry without falling into the danger of being unable to rise to a metaphysical, to a spiritual level. But if we reach the supersensible world along such a path, then not only our thinking but also our feeling life will become engaged. For at the moment in which we raise knowledge of the world to a supersensible level, we begin to gain a moral relationship with the world foundations, with the supersensible beings themselves. This element of feeling is the first one of the three soul faculties to which we have to turn in our moral and religious education. If fostered in the right way, it will become transmuted into a feeling of gratitude. This mood of gratitude, something in which today's educational practice plays only a comparatively minor and less conscious role, is what we must develop in the child quite systematically, right from the very beginning of school life. with each concrete example which we take from life itself. We must try to engender this mood of gratitude for everything the child receives. And if this feeling is rightly developed, it is capable of rising to the highest realms of cosmic laws, which can be reached through cognition. At such a moment, a human being feels how nature is surrounding him. He learns to know nature's laws, sees himself within nature. He learns to know that what he can discover by means of his senses alone will never make him into a full human being. Gradually he finds the way to a knowledge of man which points to what goes beyond the bounds of the sense-perceptible world, but which nevertheless can be reached by scientific methods. He then experiences in himself not only the working of universal cosmic laws, but he divines the existence of spiritual beings. Such awareness changes his knowledge into a deep feeling of gratitude toward the supersensible beings who have placed him into the world, toward the supersensible beings themselves. Knowledge broadens into gratitude toward divine beings. No knowledge of the world is rightly imparted to the young unless it eventually wells up into a feeling of gratitude toward the supersensible world. And so the first quality within the three human soul faculties which will lead into the moral and religious sphere, and which we must cultivate in the young, is a feeling of gratitude. Gratitude in itself includes a certain cognitional quality, for we must know why we are grateful. It is characteristic of such a feeling that it is closely allied to our powers of comprehension. In the Waldorf school, we do not appeal to a faith handed down by tradition. That is left to our visiting religion teachers, who, after the ground has thus been prepared by the regular Waldorf teachers, are invited to relate what they have to give to life in general. With regard to the pupil's faculty of thinking, we first of all try to create a mood of gratitude. And when we turn to the life of feeling, we find there something which takes us out of ourselves, which leads us out into the surrounding world. When experiencing gratitude, we find ourselves confronting other beings. But if we can identify ourselves with other beings to the extent of experiencing them as ourselves, then something begins to develop in our feeling life, which we call love in the true sense of the word. Love is the second mood of soul which needs to be nurtured with regard to the ethical and religious life. It is the kind of love which we can foster at school by doing something we can so that the pupils will love each other. It is the kind of love to which we can give a firm grounding by aiding the children's gradual transition from the stage of imitation and that of authority between their 9th and 10th year to a genuine feeling of love for their teachers, whose bearing and general behavior at school naturally must warrant it. In this way we lay the foundations of a twofold human quality. On the one hand, we implant what is contained in the ancient call, quote, love thy neighbor as thyself, close quote. And as at the same time we are also developing a feeling of gratitude, which points more to a comprehension of the world, quote, love thy neighbor as thyself, close quote, is complemented by the words, quote, love the divine being above all things, close quote. Such words of truth have a familiar ring to most people today, or they have been sounding across the ages. However, to know them in theory and to repeat them is not the point. What matters is that in our immediate present, and every age sees a renewal of mankind, we find ways and means of putting them into practice. Nowadays one hears all too often, love thy neighbor as thyself and God above all things. Yet one sees little evidence of it. Life at school should help to bring about that such things are not merely talked about, but that they become infused with new life. There is only one way which will offer a firm foundation for a mature capacity to love, and that is the natural transformation of the childhood stages of imitation and authority to that of love. And if we work in harmony with the child's natural development toward the attainment of love, the quality of which should be self-evident when seen in this context, we no longer need to invent long-winded theories of the kind that are fabricated by materialistic thinkers, with the intention of guiding the newly sexually mature adolescent in his first experiences of love. A whole literature has been written on this subject, all of which suffers from the simple fact that one no longer knows what to do with youngsters when they reach sexual maturity. And the reason for this failure lies in the children not having been prepared adequately for this event, because one did not know how to handle the previous stages of childhood. If adolescents have been guided rightly up to this incisive time in their lives, one does not have the same difficulties with them. Also, in the case of the child's life of will, we must guide his developing soul in such a way that his feelings freely flow into his willing, and this in the right way. The child naturally must express manifold will impulses outwardly, but what is it that now asserts itself? We could not be human in the physical sense if at the moment we express our will impulses, and particularly so when our deeds are seen in the light of morality and religion, we were unable to make use of our physical powers. In engendering love, we pour ourselves out into the world, as it were. In willing, we draw back again into ourselves. And since willing is an essential part of our lives, we now enter the domain of our instincts, drives, and emotions. At the moment when we are seeking the path to morality and religion, we must become conscious that into our instincts and desires there must flow that which makes us truly human. It will reveal itself to us when we knowingly contemplate the universe and find the human being there. It is what was put into words by an old tradition in the saying, quote, "Man is the image of the Godhead," close quote. Only if we can carry such an experience into our willing, only if even in the impulses of our instincts we can still find the image of God, will the kind of willing come into being which bears an ethical and also a religious character. Then we know that also in the domain of our willing we remain truly human. If a person lets his will impulses enter the world in such a way that right down to the level of his instincts people still recognize in him a true human being, what is he doing then? By developing a feeling for his own humanness, which he pours into his activities, into his will impulses, he reveals the third of the three soul moods. And for this third element, there exists no word in the German language. Therefore, to make my meaning clear, I have to borrow a word from the English language. It is the word duty. There is no German word for duty. Those who can experience how words reveal the genius of language, in the sense spoken of during a previous meeting, will be able to feel what I mean. True enough, anyone who, without further ado, translates simply according to what he finds in a dictionary, would translate the word duty with the German word Pflicht. But Pflicht does not meet the case at all. As a noun formed from the verb pflegen, it comes from quite a different region of the soul. Footnote, the verb pflegen has a double meaning, A, to nurture or to nurse, and B, to be accustomed to be in the habit of. End of footnote. One would have to approach this whole line of thinking quite differently if one were to base it on the word Pflicht. In this difficulty to find the right word, you have another example of how differently people are constituted in different parts of the earth. If one aims to be conscientious and correct in one's use of language, one cannot translate duty with Pflicht in order to express the third mood of soul, for this would be an untruth. It would be a lie, even if only a technical one. Number 1, gratitude. Number 2, love. Number 3, duty. And again, it is characteristic that one can use the German words for gratitude, Dankbarkeit. Excuse me, let me say it again. Dankbarkeit and love, Liebe, but that there is no German word for expressing the third mood of soul. It is characteristic because as soon as we step out of the sphere of cognition, which links us to humanity, for thought can be shared by all thinking people, and as soon as we leave the realm of love, which can unite people everywhere, and enter the sphere of individual willing, we find ourselves placed into a definite geographical locality. There we are called upon to form our lives and to become conscious of the individuality which is being developed in us through our having been placed into a definite location on earth. However, if we approach our pupils through their life of feeling, when, between the 9th and 10th year, the children's previous powers of imitation and their inborn sense of authority have gradually changed into new faculties, our teaching, by its very nature, will lead to a moral and religious experience on their part. And when a human being is permeated by the feeling that he wants to be truly human, that he must conduct his life in such a way that right down to the level of his instincts, his fellow men will recognize in him a true human being, and when he himself can recognize his own humanity, at this moment he becomes a messenger, an angelos of the divine world. Then his moral life will become pervaded by a religious mood. If a pupil has been rightly guided up to the 12th year, new subjects introduced at that time will lead him out into what lies outside the human realm. This will make him acutely conscious that by observing outer nature, he is entering another world, sense-bound and obeying the laws of the lifeless, the inorganic world. We have characterized this point of time and also indicated what form the right pedagogical approach should take. But at that moment, deep down, the child will feel that he wants to be truly human also at the level of man's lower nature, at the level of his instincts and drives. And then the third mood of soul will arise, the feeling of a sense of duty. In this way, through our education, and in conformity with the child's own nature, we have guided the pupil to an experience of the three moods of soul. Naturally, the ground had to be prepared already during the previous school years. At the stage of development which occurs toward the 12th year, a certain loss of inner harmony will make itself felt in the pupil's religious experiences. By this I mean that in his religious life a most important moment has come. Naturally, the pupil must have been prepared for this turning point so that he can pass through it in the right way. What must not happen is that the educator simply accepts the fact that certain conflicts brought about by our present civilization are inevitable. In our times, people have their moral and ethical views, which are deeply rooted in the human soul, and without which they cannot imagine human dignity and human values. On the other hand, they find themselves surrounded by the effects of natural laws, which in themselves are completely amoral, laws which affect human lives, irrespective of any moral issues, and which can be dealt with only if questions of morality are left entirely out of consideration. Today there is a widespread trend in educational circles, conveniently, to bypass this problem in the case of children who have reached this critical point in their lives. But in our present civilization, this conflict in the soul of man is a deep and a tragic one, unless it is resolved in some way or another before adulthood is reached. Unless pupils are able to reconcile the moral with the natural order of the world, so that these two worlds can be seen as part of one overall unity, they could well fall victim to an inner conflict strong enough to tear their lives apart. Today such a conflict exists in the lives of nearly all thinking people, only they remain unconscious of it. They prefer to fall back on traditional religious creeds, in this way trying to bridge what remains an unbridgeable gap, unless one is able to rise from the sense-perceptible world to the spiritual world, as anthroposophy endeavors to do. For the adult, such a conflict is a tragic one indeed. Should it ever arise in childhood before the 11th year, the disturbances it brings in its wake are serious enough to ruin the soul life of the child. It should never happen that a child says to himself, quote, "I learn zoology, and there I find nothing about God. I learn religion, and I am told of a God. It is true, but this does not help me to explain zoology." Close quote. To allow a child to be caught in this dilemma would be a dreadful thing, for this kind of questioning could completely throw it off its proper course of life. Needless to say, the kind of education we have been considering during the last few days would never allow such a schism to appear in the soul of a child, for it fully takes into account the importance of the 11th to 12th year, and of all that follows after. Only then, but not before, is the right time for the pupil to become aware of the disharmony between life looked at from the natural and life looked at from the moral point of view. But we should not overprotect the child by glossing over certain facts of life, such as that, apart from an experience of gratitude, love, and duty, there also exists a split in the world when seen through human eyes. However, if education is founded upon the principles elaborated here, pupils will be able to resolve this apparent disharmony in the world, especially at this particular age. These are problems which will deepen and enrich the pupils' religious lives far more than if they were to be fed merely on the traditional types of religious instruction which have to be accepted on faith. Such real content will give pupils the assurance that a bridge can be built across the abyss which they have experienced for the first time because it is a reality. Our present civilization demands that we should let our ethical and religious views play their proper part in life as it is. And in our religious teaching, we must take our cue from the critical moments of the pupil's developing life of feeling. The difficulties of finding the kind of bridge which I have spoken of are highlighted by a book which was published in London toward the end of the 80s. It is called Lux Mundi, and among its contributors are several authors representing the official point of view of the High Church of England. In this book, an attempt was made to integrate what has become crystallized within the Church more into social life. Here, even members of the High Church are at pains to build such a bridge, needless to say, from their point of view. You can find people everywhere discussing the subject, which could well become the real content of our religious life. However, are we really able to offer the growing child something that carries weight in a subject which is being debated so much today? Are we in a position to lead young people into Christianity, while theologians are arguing more and more about the real being of the Christ? Should it not be our task to find ways of helping each individual to relate him or herself to Christianity and freedom? We must not impart accepted dogmas or fixed formula in our ethical and religious instruction, but we must learn to nurture the divine and spiritual element that lives in the human soul. Only then shall we guide the child rightly and without impinging on his inner freedom toward his eventual choice of his own religious denomination. Only then will pupils be saved from inner uncertainties on discovering that one grown-up is a member of the High Church while another may be a Puritan. We must succeed in enabling our pupils to get hold of the real essence of religion. Likewise, through the cultivation of the three moods of soul, we must succeed in allowing morality to develop freely in the child's soul, instead of trying to inculcate it by means of set moral precepts. This problem lies at the very bottom of the social question, and all talking about it or working in the social field will depend on our being able to provide the right basis for the moral education of the young. A significant part of the whole social question is simply a question of education. It was only possible to present a few rough outlines of the moral and religious aspect of Waldorf education, which we have been studying during the last few days, if our educational aims are rooted in a true knowledge of man, and as long as we realize that we must refrain from introducing dogmas, theories, or moral obligations into our teaching, we shall finally succeed in laying the right foundations for the moral and religious life of our pupils. And so we must continue to work toward a true art of education, in conformity with the needs of our times. Perhaps I may hope that what I had to tell you during the last few days will have shown that I was not at all prompted by any opposition against the achievements of general education up to date. Broadly speaking, our present civilization is not lacking in good educational aims and principles. These have been proclaimed in abstract terms by the great educationalists of the 19th century in various countries of the earth. Waldorf education has no intention of opposing or belittling their findings, but it believes it knows that these ideas can become implemented only through the appropriate measures, and that such measures can grow only out of a real and deep experience of man and the world. Fundamentally speaking, Waldorf education is trying to bring about what most people are looking for, though their aims may be somewhat abstract or ill-defined. If among those who have shown genuine interest in an anthroposophically founded education, as practiced in the Waldorf school, a feeling has arisen that here ways and means are being sought in order to achieve what in reality everyone wants to see in education, then the right kind of response will have been evoked. That I was permitted to speak to you out of this spirit, ladies and gentlemen, has meant a great deal to me, for it is more important to me that you should appreciate the spirit out of which I have spoken than that you should listen to the details of what I had to bring. Details may well have to be modified or adapted in one way or another. What matters are not the details, but the spirit underlying them. And if I should have succeeded in calling forth at least some experience of that tolerant and humane, yet active spirit, out of which anthroposophically based education wishes to speak, then perhaps just a little of what I wish to bring in these lectures may have been achieved. In conclusion, I wish to emphasize once more my firm conviction that it is of utmost importance to speak out of this spirit during our present times. I should like to thank you for the interest you have shown in these lectures. I should also like to thank you for spending your time at this conference, especially so during this festive season. And I hope that, as you go away again, you may feel at least some justification for having made your journey to Dornach. If this should be the case, I should like to give you my heartiest farewell greetings, in the hope that we may meet again, in the sense in which I spoke to you at the opening of this lecture course. The end of Lecture 16. It is the end of the lecture cycle. The following, in quotes, lecture, coming after this lecture 17, is actually a set of answers to questions.